After some technical hiccups, we have now more or less got this sorted. I welcome everybody to the 37th ICANN meeting Tech Day. We had to wait for somebody called Rod to make his entrance. And so there isn't really much to say with regards to what's going on. I think we have a very good agenda. We have a few remote presentations. I would have much more preferred to have those presenters to be here, but on the other hand, it forced ICANN a little bit to work on the remote participation that we wanted to have all along. So let's see whether we can get that to work. We have a nice little agenda. As you can see, the morning meetings will start with Kim Davis. He will sign the route for us. Then Jay Daly will speak about security features in the draft application guidebook. And then the host presentation. I haven't met Joe yet or seen him yet, but let's hope he will arrive. He has the agenda, so he should come. And then by that time, Louis will have finished his writing his presentation, so he can do it. If Joe is late, then you will have to sort of shift before him. But Louis only came in just this morning, so he's excused. We have a little bit of, 15 minutes time. If we go longer or quicker or so, we can adjust the time a little bit. But ICANN is paying for the lunch, so we're getting lunch again. In the afternoon, Roy Ahrens will roll over the key and die. And then Andre will tell us a little bit about some DNS attacks they had in Czechoslovakia, in the Czech Republic, and what they did about it. And then, as a late addition, we have one and a half presentations from Chris Davis and from somebody called Dagan at Georgia Tech. I only got the presentations this morning. They participated in the Mariposa botnet takedown, and I think that's quite interesting for us because we are all affected by these botnets. And then we have a little panel about incident response. Yuri Ito will talk a little bit about the DNS cert. Roy Ahrens and Jörg Schweiger is the head of the incident response group, will sit on the panel. And Patricio will remotely talk a little bit about what happened in Chile, in particular with regards to their infrastructure and to their operations. Fortunately, none of the staff there got injured or died. And then Norm Ritchie will try, if he's still on remote, will make some closing remark, and if he's not there or he doesn't say enough, then Andre will say a few words. So, without any further ado, Kim will do his presentation. We have done this as a PowerPoint, so I have to select it quickly. Nope, yeah, that's it. And then we go to presentation. We must do it a little bit uncomfortably because it's the easiest way of getting it on the remote participation so that whoever goes on the Adobe chat can see what is being said and they can, in any case, hear what is being heard. All right, Kim, welcome.
Okay, well, I'll wait 2 minutes then. Okay, so what I'm going to do is give you an overview of signing the root zone. This isn't my presentation. It's actually a jointly compiled presentation by ICANN, US Department of Commerce, and VeriSign. I am just here as the presenter, not as the author. So apologies if I don't speak with authority on some of this. What's actually happened is whilst I'm responsible for managing the root zone at ICANN, we've had a dedicated team responsible for signing the root zone. I'll come to who's in that at the end of the presentation, but suffice it to say, this dedicated team of full-time employees have been working more or less non-stop on the root signing project. And obviously there's a nexus with what I do as my job, but I've been happily participating more as an observer than as a active contributor, just monitoring how it's been going. So anyway, so this is, as I said, it's a presentation jointly by those three organizations, and also the design of the entire workflow of how the route is signed is a result of both cooperation between ICANN and VeriSign with the support of the US government. So I'm going to talk a bit firstly about the design. How did we design the workflow associated with signing the route zone? It's probably easiest to describe sort of the design considerations by thinking about a few keywords that kind of went into the initial thinking and as the project got developed, got fleshed out a little. The first keyword is transparency. Signing the route zone is all about trust. DNSSEC is all about trust. And to trust how the route zone is signed, we need to be transparent about how it's being signed. So the processes, the procedures need to be open, as open as possible for the community to trust the signed route. And that really pervades the entire design of the route zone signing system that we're deploying to try and be as transparent as possible so the community can have great insight into everything that's going on with signing the route zone. The second keyword is auditing. It's important to us that the processes that we use are auditable. We want to meet industry standards. We want independent experts to be able to come in to test our processes, to view things like our key signing ceremonies and say with confidence that this is a secure solution that meets the goals of signing the route zone. And, of course, high security is essential. After all, this is a security application. There's a variety of standards. There's NIST standards, NIST being a U.S. government agency. And we've developed it to the high impact rating for system controls. The idea here is that we follow standards that are required for very high security applications, so we can be confident that the system isn't compromised. So, as you're probably aware from the start of my presentation, there's a number of entities involved in signing the route zone. It's not just ICANN. So I'll talk a little bit about what those roles and responsibilities are. Firstly, there is, of course, ICANN. And ICANN here performs its role as manager of the route zone as one of the IANA functions. And the role can be divided into a few different parts, and this might explain why I'm not involved in all of it. Firstly, there's an entirely new part. This is something that ICANN hasn't done before, and it's exclusive to DNSSEC, which is managing the key signing key. This is the sort of the master key that underlies the entire signing effort. So managing that KSK is ICANN's role in this methodology, and that's one of the new functions that we've taken on. Secondly, and this is more my area, is the IANA will, as it does today, accept changes to the route zone. And with DNSSEC, the way the chain of trust is installed is using DS records. So TLD operators that sign their zone will pass DS records to IANA for insertion into the route zone. That will be an addition to the current processes and is being rolled out as part of this project. Obviously, as part of just managing the IANA in general, we're there to verify and process requests to change the route zone, and we're there to send requests to update the route zone to the Department of Commerce for authorization and then on to VeriSign for implementation. Now, the US Department of Commerce is responsible today for authorizing changes to the route zone, and that certainly doesn't change with signing the route. So when we receive changes to the route zone, whether it's inserting, changing, or removing DS records, changing the KSK, and doing other related DNSSEC updates, we will do that with the authorization of the US government. What the US government does is they act as they authorize changes on the basis that they want to be confident that ICANN has followed its own processes for implementing DNSSEC. Again, that's part of the trust underlying the whole process, that we have published our methods and procedures and we intend to adhere to them in an open way, and we hope that, you know, that will be pretty evident, and that NTIA should theoretically be able to approve all changes we submit because we'll follow a closely agreed set of processes. VeriSign today is the root zone maintainer. They take changes that IANA sends and have been authorised by NTIA and implements them in the root zone itself. As a new role in the root zone management, they will be managing the zone signing key. The zone signing key is used for the day-to-day signing of the root zone. They will take any changes that NTIA authorises, as they do today, implement them in the root zone, and then sign that root zone. They then distribute the signed root zone to the root server operators, as they do today. So I have a little process flow on the screen. Probably doesn't warrant going into any great detail, but the basic workflow is TLD operators that have a signed root zone. They transmit their DS records to ICANN. We then verify that, ensure that it meets the procedural requirements. We transmit that to the US government for authorization. That's transmitted to VeriSign in an authorized state. VeriSign then generate an unsigned root. They use the ZSK that they maintain but has been signed by ICANN's KSK. They then generate a signed root zone, which is then distributed to the root servers. So one of the key parts of the security of signing the root zone is protecting that KSK. After all, with a signed ecosystem of zones all leading up to the root zone, that KSK is kind of fundamentally one the most important key to protect. Obviously, once the root zone is signed, as TLD managers, you'll be able to roll your keys relatively easily in the event of a compromise and transmit updated DS records to the root zone. But at the root zone, we don't have that same easy possibility of rolling keys. So maintaining the security of the KSK is much more important. There's a multi-layer security setup, and I'd be lying if I could step through every box on this slide and explain what each part means. But in essence, we have devised a fairly elaborate key control system where we've consulted with leading experts in the field, certainly VeriSign and their experience in managing private keys with PKI infrastructure have been of huge assistance there as well. We've engaged external security auditors that specialize in this field to design a system of physical security where we maintain the KSK in a very secure facility where we'll perform key ceremonies that are very transparent. And I think the slides will go into some detail on that. One key part of managing DNSSEC for us is what we call the DPS, the DNSSEC Practice Statement. In essence, all the roles, responsibilities, the practices, how we do things is all written in a document. And the idea is that as we maintain DNSSEC, we will slavishly adhere to this document. And this document can then be managed. It can be audited against, and it's comparable to something that already exists in the security industry. And with X509 certificates, the kinds of certificates that are used for securing your bank transactions and so forth, they maintain what's called a CPS, a certification practice statement, on how they manage keys in much the same way. One of the keys to us in managing that KSK is community trust. And in generating the KSK, in performing transactions on the KSK, we want to state with confidence that that was done in accordance with our practice statement, that there were independent witnesses that observed it being implemented and so forth. So one part of the proposal is what we're calling community trusted representatives. The idea is that We have community representatives involved in the events, such as Key Generation. These community representatives actually, by design, have to be involved in these ceremonies. They will have keys themselves, and these keys, they all have to come to some place. They have to bring their keys with them, and this is how they get access to the KSK. So as staff, we actually don't have KSK access by ourselves. We need these community representatives to come in and perform transactions with us. So this enables us to, you know, hopefully gain confidence from the community that this is being done in an open, transparent manner, that there's no ability for ICANN staff or any other actor individually to do something unexpectedly. I mentioned earlier that our aim here is to have third-party auditors ensure that we follow our practice statement to review everything we do and give independent advice to the community that we're doing what we say we do. And also, apart from those roles that actually have to be physically present to insert keys and so forth, there's also an expectation that other external witnesses will be available to watch us do these procedures and report back to the community that, yes, I was there as a witness, I saw this whole process, and I can confidently say, you know, the KSK was generated in the appropriate way. DNSSEC protocol parameters. This is a bit more technical. The KSK is a 2048-bit RSA key. The idea is that it will be rolled every 2 to 5 years and that we'll use RFC 5011 provisions for automatic key rollovers and that the signatures be based on SHA-256. The ZSK, this is the key that VeriSign will maintain. 1024-bit RSA gets rolled every quarter. Four times a year there'll be some procedure where VeriSign generates a ZSK, they send it to ICANN, ICANN goes through a process of signing that ZSK with a KSK, and it gets transmitted back to VeriSign, and that's done with those external parties. It's proposed that the signatures there are also SHA-256. Signature validity, DNS key covering RRSIG validity of 15 days, other RRSIG validity of 7 days, key ceremonies. So, I mean, the key ceremonies I was mentioning earlier where we have access to that KSK will be generation of that KSK every 2 to 5 years and then once a quarter, the signing of the ZSK for the forthcoming quarter. So once you have a signed root zone, you have all these keys. As an implementer of DNSSEC, as an end user, you need a way of obtaining the trust anchors for the root. The idea is that ICANN will be publishing the trust anchors on a website, both in an XML wrapped and as plain DS records. We will sign that. We will issue a PKS 10 certificate signing request. Basically, that will allow other third parties to sign the key as well and sort of build trust in whether that's the KSK or not. So deployment, that's an overview of how it all is structured. In terms of deployment, obviously the goal is to deploy a signed root zone. We want to deploy it with transparent processes, audited procedures, and we need to have, obviously, deployment within, validators, registries, registrars, name server operators, and so forth. Signing the root zone is a critical piece of deploying DNSSEC, but it's certainly not the only piece. We're not oblivious to that by any means. And our goal is to communicate a lot. And certainly, we've communicated in many venues on our progress in DNSSEC, certainly a lot more than sort of the standard domain community we normally communicate with. So what are the anticipated issues with DNSSEC? Well, the first one is having the DO bit set to 1. Those that follow some of the DNS sort of engineering mailing lists would have seen on and off discussions about this over time, but in essence, there's a bit in DNSSEC called DO, DNSSEC OK, that signifies that the that the server accepts DNSSEC records. It's expected that when with DOBIT set, there could be a significant proportion of DNS queries being sent with that set. Certainly, I think it's 70 or 80%. I think I might be wrong, but that kind of level. And then a potentially significant population of clients might not be able to receive the large responses that are sent back associated with DNSSEC. Another key issue is that once you've deployed DNSSEC and those, the trusted key is implemented in DNSSEC users, its rollback is extremely difficult, because if you then go from a signed zone to an unsigned zone, it presents extremely difficult practical challenges. So basically, unsigning the root zone is a very undesirable thing to have to do. So once we turn the switch it on finally and establish production signed root zone, it's not something you ever want to have to step back from. So a lot of the design of the process has been very cautious approach to rolling out DNSSEC signing with various things I think we'll get to in a moment, where very deliberate, very slow, so that we can spot problems early and avoid this rollback scenario at the end. Hopefully we can capture issues early on. So in line with that, we've taken a sort of a staged deployment approach. Firstly, we've been deploying it incrementally across the root servers. We've been starting the root zone now for, I think, since late last year. But we've just started, as of January, deploying it onto the root servers themselves. We initially started with the L root. We followed that with the A root. I believe in the last few days we've deployed it on M and I root servers. And there's obviously a number remaining, and J root will be last. The goal with this transition now, firstly with having some root servers signed, is obviously to capture any issues with those signed responses, but also by having some not signed at this point, it enables the client population that does not understand DNSSEC, that might be having some significant problems with DNSSEC, to still be able to find root servers that do not have DNSSEC enabled. This relies, of course, upon resolvers having some kind of round robining or some other mechanism that means they don't always query the same root server. But I think most key to the approach that we've taken is what we've called the deliberately unvalidatable root zone. And what this is that even though we're signing the root zone today, and even though you can query the root zone today and get DNSSEC answers, you cannot validate against DNSSEC with those, because we've deliberately blinded the signature that you're receiving from the root zone. The reason we do this is that we can test responses to DNSSEC packets without having people relying on the root zone being signed, so that if in the coming months we need to reevaluate, stop signing the root zone for whatever reason, we don't have a bunch of early adopters that have already started using DNSSEC. So this is really, I think, one of the key aspects to the approach we've taken to mitigate possible problems during deployment. So this is basically what the DNS key looks like right now. You know, there is a key, and internally we know what that key is, and we can test it in terms of our testing procedures on a daily basis to make sure it's signed correctly, but the version that's in the root servers themselves, you cannot validate against. So the approach is to deploy conservatively, prevent community validators from forming, you know, more or less repeating what I just said, so that we don't have a situation where we feel obliged to continue signing the root zone during this deployment phase. Another aspect is measuring the root servers. As we've deployed it, a focus of root server operators has been monitoring the traffic, monitoring the responses, observing any effects of this signed root zone. And there's an ongoing dialogue with the operator communities to assess the real-world impact of this process. You know, testing is also key, and we've been involved in a wide variety of testing. Obviously, there's still a lot of work to be done. And, you know, I think we're gaining experience every day, and that's going to continue. I imagine most people in the room are TLD managers, so I guess most interesting to you is how does this interact with TLD management? As I said earlier, key to DNSSEC is if you have signed your TLD, you want to you want to have your DS keys listed in the root zone. So we're adopting an approach that the DS key management will be done very much the same as, say, NS records are done today. You will communicate those with IANA. IANA will process those. IANA will submit them to NTIA and for implementation in the root zone. We expect to be able to accept DS records 1 to 2 months before final deployment of the root zone, so it's kind of May timeframe. To be honest, I wouldn't be surprised if it's much sooner. I think internally we've more or less finished getting ready for that, and once we're ready, we'll likely just open it to the TLD community. But it will definitely be at least 1 to 2 months before the root is fully signed. Communication. A website has been set up that's jointly managed by the three entities. There are status updates, documentation. We have drafts of a lot of the procedures and so forth. There's an archive of all the presentations that we've given. You know, hopefully there's a lot of useful stuff there. There's also contact information to that root DNSSEC design team. As I said, I'm not really part of that, but they're very willing to hear feedback about the process. I think, you know, one of the areas of emphasis has been communicating with non-technical audiences. I think that's something that will ramp up as we get closer to a signed root zone. Emphasis on communicating with non-technical audiences as well as technical audiences. With respect to technical audiences, obviously there's discussion in IETF forums, non-IETF forums like DNS OARC. I know there was an RSA conference that almost the entire DNSSEC team was at in the last few days, general operator lists and so forth. So the draft timeline has been spelled out to the community already, but it's worth re-emphasising that we started signing the root zone December 1st last year. Initially, that was just internal to ICANN and VeriSign, but we were doing it on a per-zone basis. Starting in January, we started incrementally rolling out that deliberately unvalidatable root zone to the root servers. It's intended by July that all the root servers will have that zone. And then on July 1st, all being well, we'll move from using this blinded key to having a fully usable, validatable root zone, and root zone will be signed and will be fully deployed. So here's the deployment status as of 24th of February, and I apologise it's a bit out of date because these slides had to be vetted in advance. We've published the requirements document, high-level architecture. Those DPSs, the policy and practice statements, have been published. We've published, not sure what trust anchor publication means, but deployment documents and so forth. So there's a whole corpus of documents on that website I mentioned a few slides ago. It's at the bottom of this slide as well. And we've also been documenting key ceremonies, KSK facility requirements, and I think from what I understand, most of the documentation has been published, if not in draft form. I think there's no major significant documents yet to be published, but there's certainly a substantial amount of documentation already published. We've been doing testing, obviously. Data collection with root server operators has been done to some extent. We've done several KSR-SKR exchanges, which means that we've taken VeriSign's ZSK, transmitted it to ICANN. ICANN has signed it, successfully transmitted it back. We've also tested, obviously, the deliberately unresolvable root zone and some resolver testing. I think at this stage, M and I have been deployed already. So I think it's 4 root servers have now been deployed. So that's kind of my scattershot rendition of a presentation that would have been given much better by someone that was actually doing the work. But hopefully I've given you a sense of the work that's gone into starting the Root Zone. You know, it's been a pretty big effort by a bunch of people from the different organisations, and they'd certainly be willing to hear your feedback on the process and, you know, how we can communicate better, how we can try and address any residual concerns the community might have. And just to give you a sense of who's involved, you know, it's a variety of people from different organisations that, you know, there's a lot of expertise in that team, and we have, you know, expertise from the DNSSEC community as well as expertise from the security community as well that have experience with PKI and so forth. So, you know, it's been a really good collaboration between all the parties, and, you know, I think, you know, I'm obviously directly invested in the outcome, but I'm somewhat an outside observer to the process within the organisation. And, you know, I was participating in key signing ceremony rehearsals in the last few weeks, and, you know, it's really impressive the amount of thought and energy that's gone into deploying what we've got. And I think over the coming months, it will be really a good thing to see. So thanks for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have. Okay.
All right, thank you very much. That was a very nice and interesting presentation. So could I ask a question from the chair first, using my privilege?
Okay.
This community key witnesses, what happens if one of them loses their key or their community sync key?
I'm not sure the precise numbers, but I believe it's a 5 of 7 scenario. So there's 7 keys and we need 5 of them. And there's also, I mean, there's multiple layers of, I won't use the right terminology, so I'll try and avoid using terminology, but there's a backup scenario where there's a second set of keys for a second facility on the other side of the country. You know, there's multiple layers of redundancy there, so that hopefully we won't be captured by any one or any couple of people.
So, yeah, I'm Curtis Lindquist from NetNode Autonomica that runs the iRoute, and we have, or indeed, signed sending the distributed assigned route. But I just had a question on the interaction between the TLDs and the registry. I know there was some discussions previously, and was wondering what the outcome was of how does a TLD handle if they end up with a compromised key? How do they push up an emergency key rollover with ICANN?
So the basic scenario is that if a TLD operator needs to do a rapid rollover due to a compromised key, they would need to submit a new set of DS records for the Root Zone. ICANN provides a 24/7 emergency hotline for TLD operators. To date, it hasn't really been used, but in concert with deploying DNSSEC, we're going to, you know, go through another round of advertising that to TLD operators so they're aware. One of the problems, though, is that, you know, by virtue of the structure of the Root Zone, is you have 3 parties. You have ICANN as a corporation, you have NTIA as a US government agency, and you have VeriSign. As ICANN, we can say to you, we have 24/7, we have a 24/7 number. What happens then is you go to a call center, which is outsourced, but what they do is take your information. They will get an ICANN employee. They have all of the available staff's mobile numbers, home numbers. They will call until someone answers, and that someone will look at it and we'll work on it straight away. That's our undertaking. However, we will do our best to make sure that NTIA get the request. We'll try and raise them. We'll contact VeriSign. We can't promise those other organizations will do the same, but we'll do our best to try and do that. But our goal is to kind of jump on that immediately, but we can't sort of promise an SLA on how quickly it will happen.
Okay, any more questions locally? Is there anybody on the remote who wants to say a question? Not really.
So I had a question. What happens when you get close to the very end of this and realize that stuff isn't going well? Has it been decided yet who has the authority to abort the rollout?
I think the decision to finally go live at the end is a joint decision between VeriSign, NTIA, and ICANN. And, you know, we're in daily communication between the three parties, and I think that, you know, basically there will be a consensus between the organisations in the end. Certainly, I think we would want to be conservative, and the intention is to be conservative, but there'll be a risk analysis on whatever issues towards the end, and a final decision will be made. The question was, is there a percentage of resolvers that, you know, is there a specific benchmark that we're looking for? And I don't think there is. I don't think anyone quite knows exactly what it will look like if we're not ready to go. But I think we're satisfied we have enough experts watching and we can engage enough people towards the end in discussion to get a good representative answer when the time comes.
I take it there's no automatic movement of information from ITAR into the root.
No, there's not.
And when does ITAR get pulled?
That's a good question. My intention is that when the root is signed, shortly thereafter, we will make some kind of announcement to the community and say, as we've noted, we intend... The ITAR was only meant to bridge the gap until the route is signed. The route is now signed. We'll engage the community to say, is it appropriate now to shut it down? And just re-consult. And then on the assumption that the community more or less agrees that's still the right approach, then we will do so with, I don't know, 3 or 6 months' notice. I'm not quite sure how long. The only concern there is it's been expressed to me the last 6 months that there are elements of the community that want ITAR to be a permanent service. And I don't know if the rest of the community cares either way or if they're adamantly against it being retained. I just don't know. So I think, you know, clearly we have to wait until the route is signed before we take action on ITAR. I don't believe it's pressing to turn off ITAR right away. But, you know, it's one less thing for us to maintain once the route is signed. So, you know, as staff, my personal preference would be for it to go away.
All right, I see no more questions. Thank you very much, Kim.
Thank you.
Okay.
So our next presentation is Jay Daly. He is remote, so I have to load and run the file locally. Jay, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Okay. You must come a
can
little
bit... Can
you
hear me well enough?
Not very well. Maybe you come a little bit closer to the microphone or we do something here?
Maybe do something there. I'm as close as I can get to the microphone here.
Okay. It's getting better.
Okay.
Can you see... just one question. Can you see the presentation or... Must I just go by the numbers?
No, I can see the presentation very well, thank you.
Okay.
So, this presentation is on security-related proposals in the draft application guidebook version 3. We are promised a version 4 at some time, but the version 3 is all we have so far. Next slide, please. So, what I should be covering is some background and some context to this, and then the two individual components of this... the mitigating malicious conduct memoranda and the high security zones memoranda, also known as the high security TLDs and high security zone verification program as well. And then some brief words about the HSTLD working group that's currently underway. Next slide, please. So hopefully you're all aware of the draft application guidebook version 3. This is the... this is consultation finished on this some months ago, but it is the guidebook that is given to applicants for new GTLDs, explaining to them the requirements to be a new GTLD. It has within it two memoranda. One is called Mitigating Malicious Conduct, which is a list of compulsory requirements from any new GTLD. And the next one is this rather unusual High Security Zone Verification Program, which is a floated idea for an optional program for new GTLDs only, where they can end up with a form of certification by proving that they are at a specific level of security. So the definition of security is something quite unusual here. There is a ICANN working group underway at the moment, set up quite recently at the same time as another one about zone file access, where people are currently discussing what their views are about this. And I'll try to give some indication of the work of that group so far, but it hasn't really delivered anything yet. Next slide, please. So I'm sure most of you are aware that 2008 was the year of security, and so was 2009, and so is 2010, and probably so will be 2011, 12, 13, and so on, quite some time. We know that security is a problem when it gets onto the front page of newspapers and takes away from the marital infidelities of film stars. And security is very big business at the moment. It's something that politicians are actively concerned about. We have quite commonly we hear about high-profile attacks, and all of this together puts ICANN in an awkward position. We have to remember ICANN is in a central position of influence. It is being threatened by the ITU, that the ITU could do certain things better, which we know it couldn't, but it's being said, and it must be seen to do something. I should be a little bit fairer. There are lots of stakeholders saying to ICANN, it must do something about this, some governmental, some non-governmental, some group involved in this area and other things. And for us CCTLDs, whilst the draft application guidebook doesn't refer to us directly, I don't think any of us can be in a bubble about this. This may apply to us someday. Some of us may voluntarily choose to do it. Some of us may be forced into it by our government. So it is something important for us to understand. Next slide, please. So my analysis here comes from my work in the Registration Infrastructure Safety Group. This is a group made up of GTLDs, CCTLDs, registrars and security companies looking at sharing data and working on common consultations or common responses to consultations such as this. I'm not presenting the risk view on this. That's well documented and published and very carefully worded. These are my own views, but they're drawn from my work I did within risk. Next slide, please. I think you missed a slide. Can you go back one? No? Okay, right then. Registry operators. First of all, start with the. This is the first element from the malicious conduct working group. The malicious conduct, mitigating malicious conduct memoranda. Just to remind you, this is a set of requirements within the draft application guidebook that are compulsory. Every applicant will be expected to fit with these. And this memorandum is quite well written, and it breaks down the individual elements that people need to be aware of. The first of these is vetted registry operators. We know that there are already many bad actors running registrars, and they are being slowly worked out and got through the system. But if we're going to end up with a couple of hundred new GTLDs, we need to be very careful that this doesn't happen at the registry level. And so this is vetting of those people who are applying to become GTLDs, both the people and the companies doing the bidding. In my view, this is generally a good idea, but there are some problems with the implementation recommended within the report. And this is something you'll hear me say quite a lot, that it's a good idea, it's just the way they're suggesting putting into action is problematic. For example, if you are just involved in a legal case, then that can disqualify you from becoming a registry operator, which allows somebody else then to just involve you in a legal case if they don't want you to become a registry operator. It's making a judgment before the courts have done it, which doesn't seem appropriate. The next thing is that there is no mention of change control. We're well aware that registries could, in many cases, turn out to be successful businesses or businesses that other people are interested in, and ownership could change hands. And it is at that point that it's quite important to ensure that vetting is conducted once again to ensure that somebody bad doesn't take over, but this isn't discussed within the document. And then there is no prevention of how to prevent gaming with multiple companies. We've already seen this with registrars where people set up shell companies and then shell companies within shell companies and other things. So we know that people do it, and we would have to put the same level of detection in place for registries, but that's not covered. Next slide, please. And next requirement is that it requires DNSSEC. And not just that the GTLD must use DNSSEC, but that it must implement DNSSEC before or at launch. So when it launches, it must have DNSSEC in place. Now, this is a huge boost for DNSSEC, and it's generally a good idea. But it's worth noting that current GTLDs and CCTLDs don't have this requirement on them. So we're asking something much more of new GTLDs than existing GTLDs. And the Root Zone Scaling Study was quite clear that while there is no problem from having far more GTLDs or TLDs, there is the possibility that doing too much at once, doing DNSSEC and IDNs and many GTLDs, will need phasing to ensure that these things work correctly. And by linking these two together, the memorandum effectively prevents that type of phasing taking place. Next slide, please. Right, the prohibition on wildcarding. Now, the ICANN board has already voted for this for existing TLDs, though there is uncertainty within the GTLD space as to how that will be implemented. Within the CCTLD space, I believe a request has gone to the CCNSO Council, and that has now pushed it out for consultation or is in the process of doing that. Within GTLDs, there are differing views whether existing GTLDs simply cannot do it, or whether they need to phase it out, because we know that a number of them do it. Now, this is another good idea, but this is something quite important for people to understand how it came about. The board vote was taken on a recommendation that came from the SSAC. It was not a standard community consultation process. So it didn't come from the GNSO community or the CCNSO community. It came direct from SSAC to the board. The board voted on it and then pushed it down to the rest of us to then implement, which many people might feel prevents the proper discussion that should take place about it. Now, in this particular issue about wildcarding, there are only very few people that disagree with this prohibition, but if that same route is used for other things, then that could be more problematic. Next slide, please. Right, the thick who is. So, as you're probably aware, within .com at the moment, there is a thin who is. So the who is data is held by the registrars, and all that the registry sees are the name server records. And then when DNSSEC arrives, they'll see the DS records as well. And the DAG, the Draft Application Guidebook, mandates the use of a thick who is. Now, many people regard this as a good idea, I certainly do, but we need to be honest about this. A thick who is gives better access to data, but it doesn't give a better quality of data. And the issue of security generally is the quality of data that you get. There are a couple of other issues within the proposal here that people have had an issue with. ICANN are saying that as well as supporting WHOIS, you will have to support any other protocol later that they say you must support. And there are people who feel that it would be unreasonable to just arbitrarily agree to support any protocol that they're so asked to do in the future. And another point that many people from the GTLD space make is that thin WHOIS is not policed properly. We have regular situations where people are unable to get access to a particular registrar's WHOIS, they deny access, or the registrar fails to provide a WHOIS, or a variety of other things that they do wrong, and very little takes place about that. And as a result of that, there is a general feeling that if that were policed properly, then much more benefit would come from that quite quickly than a longer-term process of forcing a move over to a thick who is. That's not to say the thick who is wrong, but are the priorities correct if nothing really has been done to police the thin who is? Next slide, please. Next one is central zone file access. This is a recommendation that all GTLD zone files be available through a single contract with a single point of contracting, and that from that then a security company can get access to everything. My view certainly is this is not a good idea, that there is no diversity of the security or vetting procedures that need to take place within TLDs for people to have access. I think we're all aware that very few of our CCTLDs allow zone file access at all, and for good reason. And yet that discussion hasn't really taken place within the GTLD space in relation to this. There is a view that it should, that security companies need it. They say it's absolutely vital for their work. And if you make it easier for them to do it by centralising the access, then that will provide benefit. But as anybody who has done anything in this space knows before, that if you centralise that access, then it makes it easier for all of the companies that send out fake invoices to get hold of their zone files and make their life a lot easier. Now, at the same time as the HSTLD working group set up by ICANN, a zone file access working group set up. I haven't kept up the developments there, but they do have some draft recommendations out, I believe, or a draft discussion document anyway, that came out the other day. Next slide, please. Right, abuse, contacts and policy. Now, this is a slightly unstructured discussion within the draft application guide, but there are three things they're suggesting there. The publication of abuse contacts within the IANA WHOIS database, mandated abuse policies, i.e. a requirement that you must have policies for handling abuse and some mandated content within them, and then publication of those abuse policies for registry. Now, again, my view is that the contacts idea is a good idea. In fact, I was probably one of the people who suggested it to them. That makes it easy for people to find the abuse contact or registry, but I have some problems with the rest of it. First of all, what is so special about abuse policies that they need to be put up there rather than ordinary registration policies? There is no link in the IANA WHOIS database to this is the term of these are the registration periods that we offer domain names for, or this is how you sign up to become a registrar. Yet there is a view that abuse needs to go up there. I also don't think regarded as being within scope for ICANN to determine what an abuse policy should contain. There are very different views in our community about how people should handle this type of abuse. For example, some registries are willing to be both judge, jury and executioner and take domain names down. Others believe that we should have an external process that makes a decision on whether or not to take a domain name down. And my view is that actually those of us in the CCTLD community are far better at setting these policies than ICANN would be in asking us what to do about them. Next, please. Slide, please. Okay, expedited registry request. This is very specific to GTLDs. This is where a GTLD registry asks ICANN for contractual compliance relief. In other words, they want to be let off having to fulfill their contractual duties in order to mitigate a particular security issue. This is, of course, a good idea, but unfortunately no details are provided on how this will happen or what threats will qualify. And that potentially leads to some difficulties with one GTLD asking for something that others would have asked for had they known it was available, and these sorts of things. Next slide, please. Right, high security zones. So this is the second memorandum. This is a voluntary program. So people sign up to it and prove, and then are externally assessed to show that they have met the requirements. And with that, they then get a seal that they can put up on their website saying, we are a high security TLD, and presumably the registrars can put it up saying this TLD is high security as well. It only applies to new GTLDs, though. There is no scope for an existing CCTLD or existing GTLD to be able to do this. It has a very wide scope of the things that it wishes to cover as well. So as well as doing the registry-specific IT and data security, it also extends to general IT and data security in many ways. And this whole document is a very messy document. What I'm presenting next to you is a breakdown of this into topics, that is my breakdown, and through colleagues within Registration Infrastructure Safety Group, but it's not presented in a document this way. It's almost a discussion paper. Next slide, please. Okay, general IT security. Now, the document gives within it some tables of things that it might be useful to certify against, and from those I've extracted some key lines here to help you understand what they mean by general IT security. So they mean security management, personnel security, which presumably means checking that you're not employing a spy working for you, physical access control, and then data collection, use, retention, access, etc. But, as we all know, there are already plenty of standards available to these. The most famous one being ISO 17799, which is quite established. And there are already plenty of companies out there who are expert in auditing whether you comply with those standards. And there are plenty of training courses and books and other things that you can buy to do that. So this is really reinventing the wheel if we're going to expect ICANN to take some bits of these of this standard that it thinks are appropriate and then put those into the requirements of the new GTLD. Next slide, please. Next thing we have is registry-specific IT security, which includes things such as a name resolution service management, pardon me, DNSSEC deployment plan. But the first question we have to ask is, what existing registries really agree on these? I know from discussions with colleagues that I do name resolution one way. For example, I would only countenance in bailiwick name servers. And I know others who deliberately have out-of-bailiwick name servers. And I think they're mad and they think I'm a lunatic. So this is, you know, quite clearly there are lots of differences within these. The next question, of course, is what makes security so special from other operational practices of a registry that we need to feel about this, but we're not interested in other things that go to affect the quality of a registry? For example, whether a registry has particular grace periods or what type of billing process it does or what quality of data it expects or what data fields it expects. There are all sorts of things that could be looked at that could be used to objectively judge a registry, yet those are not being considered. We're only looking at a few that might be useful for this wide notion of security. Next slide, please. Okay, the next one is registry performance. And includes these marvellous gems of who is service availability, who is service performance level, and who is service response time. But the question has to be asked, what has this to do with security? Now, if you go back to what security companies say, they will say that access to the who is absolutely vital to them in order for them to track down registrant information. The claim that they will make is that whilst the data given may not be correct, i.e. it may be false data presented, it is very likely that the same false data has been reused in lots of other places. And there have been numerous cases where a particular line of an address has been used in different registries that is clearly false. But this is going really quite beyond that when we're talking about who is service response time and various other things. And so there's a general feeling that pardon me, ICANN are stepping too far with this one as well. Next slide, please. Right, verification of a registrant. And yes, this is verification of identity for registrants of new GTLD. Now, the views that others expressed to me are, first of all, that this is completely out of scope for ICANN, that it would break the entire GTLD business model. The GTLD business model is not based on checking whether or not somebody is who they say they are before they allow to register a domain name. I know some CTTLDs do that, but many don't. There is also a very strong view that identity fraud already works extensively within the domain name market. Many domain names, probably the majority, are bought with credit cards, and people are regularly stealing credit cards and committing identity theft or an identity fraud in order to register a domain name with a stolen credit card. So this is not necessarily going to tackle anything. And then we have the equal access requirements, which is, again, very specific to GTLDs. this requires GTLDs to treat every registrar equally. But if this comes in, then it would enable GTLDs to say to registrars, well, you're not doing the right kind of verification identity, or you're not doing it at all, so I won't deal with you. And it begins to break that equal access requirement, which has been seen as a fundamental part of the GTLD market so far. Next slide, please. Verification of entitlement. Now, when I read this within the draft application guidebook, I think my jaw dropped open. Everything up until now had been about security, and then snuck in there was this little line, which I'll read. Other considerations, such as controls to address intellectual property concerns, could be added as components of future consideration in the lifecycle of the program. I certainly feel this is not a security issue at all. And I go further and say that I'm worried to see it actually included within what is a security-related document. Intellectual property concerns are, of course, entirely valid, but there are processes for dealing with that. UDRP within the GTLD space and various other systems within the CCTLD space. But to see it insinuating itself within to a security document written by ICANN as a potential extension of a security-based program is really quite worrying. And I've certainly seen people make comments that this is an indicator that ICANN may not really have understood just how much the intellectual property community, you know, can get into some of these areas. Okay, next slide, please. Registrant-registrar interface. So this talks about setting a standard for the way that registrants deal with registrars. For example, mandating two-factor authentication or mandating out-of-band communication, such as receiving a text message telling you that somebody wants to change your name servers and you need to text back to authorise it. Now, this is another good idea, a very good idea, but it is out of scope for ICANN. It is, in my view, something that registrars should be doing and should be offering as part of their own differentiation. And registrars have made the comment that by mandating anything in this, you prevent registrar differentiation. Now, one of the problems that registrars have had when tackling this so far is that all domains are not equal. Some people register a domain for a two-month campaign. They register for the minimum period they can, and they're really not worried about it. Some people run a multi-billion dollar business of a domain and would protect that domain with everything available to them. And yet, if we set a baseline security standard, we are treating all domains as equal. And I think this is the view of many registrars, is that they should offer services to registrants that allow registrants to choose how they wish to do this. Finally, we get to the same problem of equal access requirements as to whether or not the registry has to treat registrars differently if some are willing to engage in this and some are not. Next slide, please. Right, so a summary of these things then. Altogether, the discussion that has been brought out from these two memorandum is a very good discussion. It's just a very odd venue to see it taking place within the draft applicant guidebook. It's almost as though I kind of thought, well, doing these things for existing TLDs is too hard. We'll just do it from new GTLDs onwards, and hopefully there'll be enough of them that either we'll have momentum or people won't worry about the old ones. And we won't worry about CCTLDs because they're too awkward. So really there are things within that that need to be brought out and need to be discussed in a much wider forum because they affect all of us. And yet they're buried away within this draft application guidebook. There are some big issues within here as well. First of all, we have a change in ICANN scope. I am very concerned that ICANN potentially are aiming to operationalise some changes in their scope, which I would like to see done by a diverse set of organisations, such as the DNS cert and the high security zone area. There is in some ways a disregard for GNSO policy process within this as well. There are some things that ought to be taken through the GNSO policy process but are simply being mandated within this. The next thing is a lack of empirical evidence. We do have many organisations pressuring ICANN to do things about this. That's very clear, and ICANN have been very upfront about who they are and what they've been saying. But we don't have the proper research that tells us whether any of these things will work. In fact, it's slightly further than that. We don't have the proper research that tells us how they will work, what impact they will have on the market overall. It could be that these, for some of them, for example, if verification of registrant identity is agreed, stifles the new GTLD market altogether and leaves the incumbent GTLDs running away with the market entirely for some years until that is revoked. The other thing is restricted scope as well. There's a one slide that hasn't been brought out properly, which is this is my mistake, I think, actually, which is about orphan glue, orphan name servers as well. One of the things that ICANN are recommending is the prohibition on orphan name server records, which they mistakenly call orphan glue, within a single registry. So this is something where a registry will be required to check that the name servers that appear within for their delegations, if they're within their own zone, must be for valid delegations to prevent orphans. Now, that is a genuine problem that does need to be tackled. But as our colleagues in Japan showed us, there is an equally large problem where people have created name servers for delegations in other TLDs, and those delegations do not exist in other TLDs. And yet there is no discussion about how that would be resolved throughout this document. And that form of restricted scope, just looking at new GTLDs, doesn't give us the real solutions we need there. But overall, there is lots for us to think about within this. And then finally, just the HSTLD mailing list or working group. This is a working group with a lot of committed people on there so far, but it is struggling to find any agreement on what the nature of a solution might look like. Some people are very in favour of a certification program. Some people would like to see a voluntary checklist. Some people think that if we end up with a $20 registration for a secure one, that's fine, but some people think we end up with a $1,000 registration for a secure TLD, then that's fine. So I don't see anything happening with that yet, and the timetables on it look like it could be some time before it delivers. But for those of you who are patient and can read long emails, I suggest you join that group and have a look at it. So, final slide, please. So, that's my presentation. I hope you all could hear me properly, and excuse the coughing, and do you have any questions?
Thank you very much. As usual, a very interesting presentation, and I'm also very happy that it actually worked with the remote presentation. Are there any questions? Oh, you got us all stunned, it looks like.
All bored, yeah.
We are all in awe. All right, thank you very much. You can go to bed now.
Okay, thank you.
And we'll talk to you later.
Bye then.
As he is in New Zealand, of course, he was very late in the day, so he stayed up for us. All right. Just hang on for a second. I must just make some little preparation here. So, now we come to the usual host presentation, and our host, Joe Kiragu, will speak about their setup, and I hope he will also tell us a little bit about their technical situation. They changed their registry software in the last few years twice, and it's quite interesting to hear the experience that came with that.
Thank you very much, yeah. I'm going to give a presentation of Kenya Network Information Center, a brief overview of Kenya Network Information Center setup, our current domains that we are offering, our marketing that we the marketing policy that we put in place right now, and also talk about our registry system, as the chair said. So Kenya Network Information is a multi-stakeholder registry, public-private partnership, where we have members from different stakeholders. We have members from telecommunication service providers, which is an association of the ISPs and telco companies, Communication Commission of Kenya, which is a regulator, Kenya Education Network, representing the academia, Domain Registrars Association, representing all the registrars, Kenya ICT Action Network, Directorate of E-Government, that is from the government, Kenya ICT Federation, and the Kenya Internet Marketing Association, among others. Now, like I said, the Kenic board is comprised of both public and private, and most of them are from the government sector. However, the chair and the vice chair is elected from the private sector, just to balance the private and the public sector. The constitution also allows for rotation of membership, so that, for example, in my previous presentation, those are the members of the board right now. So after every 3 years, we elect different board members. Now, the objective of the .ke registry, KENIC, is to manage and operate the KE, CCTLD, promote utilization of the .ke namespace, promote growth of development in ICTs in the rural and low-price areas, and also present Kenya in various international meetings and local events and conferences like the ICANN meeting, AFTLD, EAIGF, and the rest. Now, in the recent 1 year, KENIC has been involved in the following initiative. KENIC was involved in the establishment of the East African Internet Governance Forum and also the Kenyan chapter of the IGF. KENIC is pleased to host that 7th ICANN meeting. Recently, last week from the 2nd up to 7th of March, KENIC was hosting the 4th AFTLD event, where we held the AGM and IROC training. KENIC is also involved in the IP version 6 task force. We now have an IP version 6 test bed. We're going to roll out in the next month. We just received equipment from Cisco. KENIC is also involved with the regulator in coming up with the CERT, Computer Emergency Response Team. KENIC is also conducting right now a research on CCTLD best practice in East Africa CCTLDs, that is Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania. KENIC is working with its partners, the Kenya ICT Action Network, on conducting this research. KENIC has also facilitated the FROOT, JROOT, and COM and .NET root servers in collaboration with the Kenya Internet Exchange Point. KENIC also have a NTP server that most telecom providers in the country use. KENIC is also the caretaker of the national information portal, kenya.info. And KENIC was also very instrumental in coming up with the Internet Exchange Point, the Kenya Internet Exchange Point. And KENIC works a lot with the Kenya Internet Exchange Point in building capacity in ICT in the country. Now, the model that KENIC uses is a registrar model, where KENIC has registrars, accredited registrars. We have currently, we have over 120 registrars, and then we have over 12,900 domains as per yesterday in the evening. We offer second level domains, not at the first level. Now, these are the various second level domains that KENIC has been offering. Since inception, we had 6 sub-level domains: co.ke for commercial, or.ke for non-profit organization, ne.ke for infrastructure, ac.ke for academia, and sc.ke also for academia, go.ke for government institution. Go.ke is vetted, so you have to be from a government institution or from the government to get a go.ke. The same for the academia second level domains. You must get an approval from Ministry of Education to get an AC.K or a CL AC.K. Now, in January 2010, we migrated to the new system. Before, we were using a Brazilian system. We have moved to COCA. And after moving to COCA, we have introduced three additional subdomains, which is ME.K for personalized domains, Info.K for information, Mobi.K for mobile content. Now, these three subdomains, the main focus for this is on local content. This is the next phase that we are looking at, especially after the landing of the three fiber optic cables in the country, CECOM, TIMS, and the other one that is due to arrive. KENIC inception was in March 2003, after the delegation to KENIC. And since inception, when KENIC was started in 2003, we were using the Brazilian system. However, there were some drawbacks when we were using the Brazilian system. We were not able to extend that code. We were not able to enrich the registry system to serve us better in line with our policies. And KENIC right now is using the COCA framework. Since January 2010, we migrated to the COCA. And some of the advantages that we have realized after migrating to COCA, as listed below, it's easy to extend the COCA framework using EPP. And since it's open source, we are able to extend to integrate with other payment solutions and other third-party portals. Right now, we are integrating our COCA tool to some payment local payment gateways. One very common payment gateway is a mobile transfer of money called M-Pesa by Safaricom and Zap. So right now, we are integrating with M-Pesa so that our registrars and registrants are able to pay for their domains using their mobile. The COCA tool has also helped us to have a system which is multi-user and multi-system, so we can have registrars have different accounts for their registrants, or registrars can also go ahead and have resellers. So the system is able to provide that. The system is also flexible. We're able to introduce other second-level domains, and we're also able to host other TLDs on the same system. Recently, there was an enactment of the Communication Amendment Act 2009, whereby the regulator is going to issue license to anybody who wants to run a second-level domain. So KENIC, we have already provided that platform using the COCA framework. Anybody who wants to run a second-level domain in Kenya will be able to run that. We'll be licensed by the regulator, and we can be able to host them on our registry system. The other issue we've realized is automation of course, invoicing and domain clearance. With the BR system, we had to flag the domains. For example, if one has to renew a domain, we had to go to the system and do it. Registrar didn't have a way of going to the system and flagging the domain, let's say, for renewal, or you want to hold the domain for a certain time. But now with the new registry system, registrars have the control of the domain. They renew the domain whenever they want to do. If they want to suspend the domain for a certain period, they can be able to do that. The new system is also prepaid. The previous system, they had to register the domain, then pay for the domain later. Whenever they want to renew the domain, they had to pay for the domain, then ask us to flag the domain. Now, the new registry system is a prepaid system. As long as they have units on their account, they're able to register as many domains as they can. They're able to renew as many domains as they can, as long as they have units in the account. The new system also allows us to use password tokens, which makes it more secure. And also, we have a better reporting system and data mining engines. So users, our registrars and our registrants can be able to now to use the system more flexible compared with the BR system that we were using before. To encourage uptake of .ke domains, KENIC has discount policy for both bulk registration and if you're taking up a domain for longer years. Now, if you're taking up a domain for bulk registrations between 0 and 50 domains, if a registrar has between 0 and 50 domains, they don't get any discount. If a registrar has between 51 and 250 domains, they get 5% discount. If they have between 251 and 500, they get 7.5, all the way up to 50%. If a registrar has more than 2,000 domains, then they get 50% discount. We also have discount policy for registrars or registrants who take up domain for longer. For 1 year, there's no discount. For 2 years, 5% discount. 3 years, 15% discount. All the way up to 5 years is 25% discount. Our renewals and registration is up to 5 years. However, with the new system, we're able to go up to 10 years. But since our policy is up to 5 years, we are currently doing up to 5 years. But the beauty of the new system, if we change our policies to 10 years, then it's just easy to integrate that. The reason why we came up with a discount policy is because of renewals of domains. Because we realized that we were doing so many registrations in a month, but in the same time, you're losing so many domains. So we came up with a discount policy so that people can be able to take up domains for longer years, and they can be able to renew their domains, because if registrars have more domains, they're able to encourage their end users to renew their domains. Now, Kenic has, as I said, has introduced new 3 sub-level domains, and we are currently doing a campaign to sensitize the community and the internet users the reason why they should take up .ka domains. So our campaign is...
Norm, this is the Adigo operator. Christina Nordstrom wanted me to let you know that the next call will not start until 11:45 UTC.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'm going to take them back off mute so you can finish hearing.
So our campaign is centered on why.ka, and we have 3 main reasons why we're telling the internet users locally and also elsewhere to use the .ka's. Is that one reason, you have a choice compared with the other GTLDs. You are saying that you are Kenyan, patriotism, and it's unique compared with the other GTLDs. I don't think that might be very clear. We have these brochures in our stand, so you can have this on your way out. The slogan for .ke is K-E for every name in Kenya. Thank you very much. Asante, which means thank you in Swahili.
Unfortunately, we have a little issue with the batteries for the handheld microphone, so we may have to wait a moment. But thank you very much. Can you tell us, now that I can abuse the privilege of the chair again, a little bit about how difficult it was to migrate from .br to the Coca tools, and how difficult it was to start from your previous manual system to get onto an electronic system in the first place?
Okay, thank you, Chair. I think for us, migrating from the BR system to the COCA was not mainly a challenge so much, because both of them are database-driven, and for us, it was just migrating one database to the other. However, the BR system was written in Portuguese, so we had to actually sit down and learn some Portuguese. We also had to sit down and try and decode the database, because even the database, the schema, was written in Portuguese. But after that, everything was easy from there, because we just migrated that data to the new database. COCA, we had to work with a local consultant, because we realized that working with the team from COCA all the time was becoming a challenge. So we engaged one consultant locally here, who is also helping the .ng Nigeria also come up with their system. And our consultant has been very instrumental for us coming up with the registry system. After migrating to the new registry system, of course, there are teething problems that come with the new system. So we, first of all, did a pilot with the registrars. For 2 months, we had a separate system running with the BR system. And during that time, we were able to catch most of the bugs that were on the COCA registry system that we launched. coming from the manual system in 2003 to the BR system, Kenny had to go around trying to benchmark with other registries to come up with a registry system. And we got good help from the Brazilian system. We got good help from the BR, and that's how we actually came up with the BR system initially in 2003. We are still fine-tuning our registry system. We still have a few issues to finish up, especially integration with online payment gateways. We are currently working with other local payment gateways to see whether we can integrate credit cards and debit cards, especially local debit cards. Maybe I can get a question, any other question maybe from the floor, yeah.
Were there any policies in the COCOS system that forced you to change the policies in the way that you ran .ke?
Yes, I would say yes and no, because initially when we were starting with the COCA, there were some policies which were difficult to actually come integrate our current policies. But we sat down with our consultant and COCA, and we tailored, because the good thing, the COCA platform is open source. So we were able to change a few things, and at least now everything is in line with our current policy. Yeah.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. Okay. This was quite an interesting presentation.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I'll seek you out personally for one or two issues, because I want to get hold of your data mining stuff.
Okay.
Because I'm quite interested, if it's open source, I might be even be interested in that we share this with others, because I've seen two things on your website which is quite cool, which I would like to implement myself. Thank you very much. So, the next presentation is from Luis Espinosa about the total cost of DNSSEC, or total cost of ownership, but we must quickly get the logistics right.
Okay, sorry. I'm in the middle of you and the lunch, then I will try to be fast. But this is a topic that is a big concern for us. We are a small CCTLD, .cr, Costa Rica. We have around 12,000 domains right now. And everything about DNSSEC is new for us, and we try to define how will we cost that implementation for us. I try to establish three areas of investment, or three areas of the deploy on DNSSEC, and processes, technology, and people. The point of view of process, there's a RFC 4641 to establish some guidelines for best practice in this implementation of the DNSSEC and operations. And the main things are the generation of the keys process. One of the things is important here is the calculation of the keys should be on a device, on a special device that has a standard like FIPS. And after that, the store of the keys is very important. It should be on the anti-damper device, on something like HSM. And all of these things are relatively expensive, but not so high. Okay, the CS key and KS key signing process suggests the signing process should be offline, and then provide a secure copy of signed songs to the master server. Most of the recommendations are based on the PKIA certificate authority management, the typical management of the keys in this kind of technology. Then that practices and that processes is translated to DNSSEC, and now the CCTLD managers must manage this kind of relative new stuff for us. The point is trust. The security process is pointed to provide trust in the signer. Then, how much can be invested in trust? I asked you, how much certificate authority invests in trust? How much a bank invests in trust? And how much a registry should be invested to be a trust anchor? This is one our big question. This is our model of security. In the first scenario, we only have, we are using Fred, like a back-end engine to manage the zones. And after Fred, the zone is published to the public DNS. And on the right side, there's a model we define for the new development or new deploy of DNSSEC. Now the second layer, the stealth server is not an option. Now the recommendation is you should have a stealth server. In our case, we didn't really have it, but well, now we need to set up that server. And after the stealth server, we have Fred again, and we define to provide a new zone where the signed zone is stored to be used by Fred and then to be published to the stealth server and then published to the public DNS. And the signer is who's have the keys. This is the most important thing in this process. That's because it's at the bottom of the pyramid. It's at the highest level of security. And according to the recommendations, this last layer of process should be offline. Even then, each of these layers has a cost. Between deeper layer is a higher cost. Okay, what about technology? Technology not always solved everything. In the case of technology, to manage the keys, it's already in the market some HSM devices, hardware security module devices, around $20,000. The physical security to protect that HSM could be provided, but according to the standards, it could be expensive. It's a very high standards of security, protection that maybe not fit the typical data center, and to be provide more more security. It is possible in the case of manage of the tables of DNS with increasing of data, it's possible to increase the memory of the servers and the capacity of the processors to manage the new zone signed. And typically, the memory of server is a low cost. It's not a big issue. The modification of software is relatively easy. It's a new field, something like that, for the clients to provide the DS record, and maybe a little modification in the process to capture that information. In our case, some part of the process is running on Fred, and Fred, and this software is ready for that kind of fields. The field required to provide DNSSEC. In the area of people, the operations personnel have a cost of training. I think it's relatively low. In technical personnel, there's many new processes here, and maybe the needs of new personnel too. And this could be high for our organization. And there's some change of organizational culture in this new development and this new deploy. This kind of change could be high in cost. Some numbers. According with the ENISA study, the anticipating capital and operational expenses could be, by example, for a registry between 250,000 euros and 1.250 million euros. That's a big number, especially for small CCTLD. And for the registrar, they expect a 10,000 euro anticipating cost expenses, and for the recursive resolver operator between 15,000 euros and 250,000 euros. But my concern about this is not the registrar or not the recursive resolver operator, it's about registry, because it's what we run. Then, even the lowest expense or the lowest expectation expense, 250,000 euros, is a huge money for a small CCTLD and maybe for a medium CCTLD, and that's only to provide DNSSEC. That is needed, but the value added is relatively simple for the user. What should be the appropriate investment in this development? What should be the balance in provide reasonable trust anchor for a small, medium, or large CCTLD manager? What should be the level of security to protect the keys? All the recommendations of RFC should be followed, or is needed more than that? That's part of my questions, and I'd like to know if any of the audience have an opinion or have answers to these questions. Yes, just give me a little. And there's a last thing about this, the scalability of cost. Some of the cost depends on how much domains you have. By example, the amount of memory, the amount of servers, because the increase of the size of the zone should be high, then you need more memory for the servers and more bandwidth. That cost is related with the size of the CCTLD. But some of the cost is no matter what the size of the CCTLD. By example, the key, the management of the keys. That cost is fixed. Because if you are a small CCTLD and you should follow the best practice, it's the same procedures or the same process that if you are a big CCTLD, and the keys are the same. And maybe another cost that is fixed no matter what the size is of the CCTLD is the software modifications. But this is not a big issue. The thing is, the keys management is could be very expensive. And no matter what the size of the CCTLD, it will cost the same. Then it's important to find alternatives to the numbers provided by the NISA. This is not exactly a conclusion. The idea is provide some ideas and share some of your opinion on this. Like I said, the cost to be a trust hacker is very high for small CCTLD, according to the NISA study. And most of the cost of the be a trust hacker are the same for small, medium, or large CCTLD. Then, now I like to listen from the audience opinion about these questions that I really have. I don't have the answer right now because we are starting on this, but I like to hear something about. Yes.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Roy Adams. I work for the UK Registry, Nominet. I've got a few remarks and hopefully a few answers to your questions. First of all, you mentioned RFC 4641. That's actually a fairly old draft. Currently, we're in the IETF rewriting that draft.
Yes.
To become a better standard and more current. Then I noticed the other thing. You mentioned that the cost of managing keys, Nominet, together with the Swedish registry and the Dutch registry, have been involved in a project called OpenDNSSEC. And OpenDNSSEC is basically an open source tool that will manage the keys for you. It will talk to an HSM for you. So there is a very, very low startup cost to start deploying DNSSEC when using OpenDNSSEC. Then I also noticed $20,000, that's what I understand, for an HSM. That's actually relatively high in the market. There are cheaper HSMs. And for instance, if you want to use an HSM for key signing, which is what DNSSEC is basically, for instance, at Nominet, we use an £800 HSM. This is called an SCA 6000. It's an off-the-shelf hardware. It is FIPS certified, and it basically satisfies all the requirements that we had at Nominet. Now, of course, our requirements might be different than from other registries. For instance, I know that VeriSign is a registry. They have a slightly different FIPS standards to adhere to. But I think what we have built will satisfy, in general, a lot of the requirements that a lot of CCTLDs have. One final point, Bind 9, the latest version, 9.7.0, can do automatic online signing. I know it's a slight, slightly off the standard, 4.6.4.1, that says don't do online signing. But if you're willing to go around that, Bind 9.7 does actually do online signing. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other comment? Okay, I would yes. Thank you for the information. Yeah, the reference of the RFC. Yes, I know this a new standard. But the thing is that we are really trying to using OpenDNSSEC for matching the keys. But I believe that the cost. Part of the cost is the process and the process itself, the management of the keys, not only the software that manages the keys, the property management of the keys, to keep secure, to keep private. And I think this online, offline sign maybe is not. It's not a good idea because I think it's trespassing a little bit the best practice. I don't know. I'm not so sure because most of the recommendations in this kind of insecurity is that if you want something secure, you must keep it offline. This is the thing. But it's not practical. Maybe it's maybe some difficult to manage.
Thank you. I'll keep this short. Okay. On the part of developing a policy, a security policy, you're absolutely correct. That is what every registry needs to invest time in. For instance, what do you do in an emergency key rollover? What do you do when the HSM breaks down? All these kinds of procedures need to be developed. Now, also, there's a solution for that. What Sweden currently is developing, actually, Kirai is a company that works for them, it's a consultancy company, but they have developed this boilerplate policy, right, that will make it very, very, we are using it, that will make it very, very handy to just fill out the variables that apply to your organization. And so this will help you develop, for instance, procedures, and this will also help to educate staff to the point that they're comfortable with deploying the NSF.
So. Okay, I understand.
I mean, maybe I also make a small comment. The costs are only there if you do it the right way.
Yes.
Yeah, I've got 2,035 names, and I just hack a Perl script and do this, and that works. And then Andre tells me once a month I forgot to sign lisse.na, so I must re-sign it. And the cost of that was zero. Yeah. But that's not, we haven't got a bank yet. Once a bank starts, then we have to start looking at this, to do this right, to do it according to the, once we actually use DNSSEC for secure purposes and not just for to show it can be done, then you start at the cost. But the point I'm trying to make, even as a small CCTLD, you can start getting the expertise and figuring this out, and then step by step, and when you've figured it out so far that you can say, okay, it is now in a stage where we can allow a bank to use it, then you probably are easier in or more comfortable with spending money on it.
Yes. No. Okay. Yeah. Just to answer.
Enough time.
Yes. Yes, but I think the trust rely on the procedures or the process that you follow when you do something. Then the your clients or your users can trust in you like you are doing right now. But if they want to check something, or if they have a little bit of not trust, then maybe the model can fall down. It's too easy for lost the trust. It's too easy. It's just slight. But keep the trust is hard. That's because the expenses in investment in trust is high in many of the things. It's sure we are not banks, but we manage the URLs for banks, then we must be trustable, I think.
Yeah, what I'm saying is, what I'm trying to say is, it's easy and cheap to do it, but it's not easy and cheap to do it right. Yeah, as soon as we get somebody who is, we're doing it just because we wanted to do it, so to say. As soon as we get a demand and we get banks to use it or secure companies want to have it, then we have to put all this in place. But the point is, the startup cost can be small to get experience and expertise, so then you don't have to make a huge investment up front. As soon you get your learning curve, you figure out how this works, you learn this, and then when you start to put it into production, where you have to put the expenditure, you have that part that you worry whether it works or not, not so much.
Hi, my mind may have been wandering, but I don't remember you discussing whether you're looking at NSEC or NSEC3. I guess most people are looking at NSEC3. And if you're looking at NSEC3, are you looking at hashing everything in the zone or only those that you actually want to sign and then leaving the rest completely unsigned and unhashed? And in which case, your zone increase will be very, very minor.
Talking about the bandwidth and the size of the zone, yes, it's not my main concern. Because there's a cost there, of course, but not my main concern. Andre?
Bandwidth is cheap.
I just wanted to commend the study of ENISA, because as far as I know, it was concluded based on the queries to large CCTLDs that did the DNS implementation, and usually all those costs also covers the development of the system. So I think like the €250,000 is, I think it was written by us, I guess, and it's the lowest cost probably, and it covers the whole development of the threat system, the change in threat system and all that stuff. So if you use some system like Threat or COCA, which is done by third party, you don't cover those costs. So the cost of implementation for small registries are much lower, in fact, than this huge number. So I don't think the you know, small registries should be afraid of enormous cost of implementation of DNSSEC.
How much could be the cost or the real cost of thinking about Threat? For example, we use Threat.
It's hard to calculate now.
Yes.
Holding the microphone, but honestly, the majority of the of that sum went to the development of the system and writing papers that were not available at the time. But if you use really system like an OpenDNSSEC, for example, I think it will be a really small portion of that cost. And remember also the cost of the personal costs in Europe are very different than personal costs in the small countries that have small registries. So really, I believe that it can be really a small fraction of that sum if you implement it in for some small registry.
I was always worried about the hardware cost, but if I can get a dongle for €1,000, £800, €1,000 is not that much.
€1,000,
£800.
That's
dongle that is good enough for .UK is probably good enough for .NA as far as I'm concerned.
Yes.
We got there.